Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Okay, we're live at CodeMash with Bill Wagner, author of Effective C Sharp, More Effective C Sharp. Did I get that title right? Okay, MVP and Regional Director. And Regional Director indicates that's kind of like a super MVP. Do I have that right?
A lot of what the RD program is about is rather than the MVP program, you know, you're concentrated on one product or one area of expertise. And most of the RDs have some broad expertise across a lot of the different products that Microsoft offers. So in my case, and you know, I have a particular affinity for C# and the developer tools. I certainly have some knowledge of most of the other Microsoft developer stack. Other RDs would have more knowledge around maybe Silverlight or VB.NET or WCF or whatever it may be, but we'll usually be pretty competent around most of the developer tools.
And it's a relatively small group of people.
There's about 120 worldwide.
So okay, that's relatively, given it is. Microsoft is 90,000, and I don't know how many MVPs we have, that's a relatively small number.
Yeah, somebody looked it up recently, there's 4,000 MVPs, so that's still a pretty small group too.
There you go. Yeah. That's great. Well, welcome.
You outnumber us.
Yeah, we do, and we intend to keep it that way. We're here at CodeMash. You and I have spoken. Our long-term friendship, if I may call it, if I may presume, has been a CodeMash friendship.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun meeting you and learning some of the Silverlight stuff in your sessions last year and spending quite a bit of time at lunch and chatting around the water park.
Yeah. It was great. And one of the things that I really, really like about CodeMash, it's a regional conference. I put that in quotes because it's quite a big conference. And you get this wonderful combination of very high quality tech talk with incredibly, incredibly friendly folk.
You know, and I really hope it keeps that way. There's a interesting article my business partner wrote that I'll have to send you the link to so you can post it on sort of the origins of CodeMash. And it wasn't always this big. The first year or two, it was less than a quarter the size it is now, I think. The first year, the organizers were actually worried that they would get enough attendees to pay for the deposit they had to put down to rent the Kalahari.
So unbelievable. And this year, I think they sold out in about 15 minutes.
Yeah, it was actually 2.5 days, but it was over a weekend. So
pretty impressive.
We're pretty proud of that, I think, and everybody here should be. And you're right. I think there's that Mary Pavendick said it's a conference with just good old-fashioned Midwestern hospitality. So I really hope it continues to retain that character as well. It's a great tradition out here.
Well, being an Easterner, I'm not quite used to hospitality, but I'm getting comfortable. So you are mostly still focused, if I'm right, on C#.
Definitely. That's the shiny toy that still attracts most of my interest. You know, there's things I'm trying to learn outside of the C# arena, but that's still where a lot of my focus is. And I think it's going to stay that way for a while. I think there's a pretty good run left in that language, and I don't find many things that I really have too much pain doing in C# to make me really want to look at something else yet.
And there's some new features that are still on the way and still being cooked in.
Yeah, so what's announced already, the C# vNext, I don't know if they've given it an official name yet. The big thing that was announced at PDC was the async features. And I have to admit, I don't know as much as I want to yet about those, but I'm starting to play with it, and I like the ideas there. And then there's some rumblings. Eric Lippert's blog has some discussion of something that might come sometime after that version, which will include the compiler's service features. And I don't know of anything else that's been publicly announced.
Well, the async feature, I spoke with Ian Griffiths quite a bit about.
Right.
But the tell me about the
compiler's service. Okay, so for historical reasons, obviously, the C# compiler today is written in C++. It's hard to write a compiler in a language you don't have a compiler for yet.
Yes.
So the production C# compiler is written in C++, and for the same historical reasons, there isn't a managed API into the compiler. It is an engine that takes in C# code, text, and produces IL. So one of the things that's on the table for a future version is to have a set of managed APIs for the compiler. Now, this is far enough out in the future that we don't know exactly what it's going to be, but it should enable things like doing REPL loops, interactive C# shells, which would be great. Being able to
let me stop you there and sure. Just say a little bit about what that would be and why it would be great.
Okay, REPL loop is read, evaluate, print loop. Sorry, get too used to acronyms. So the idea is that you could just type in C# like you can in F# Interactive or in say the Ruby console and just execute that code.
Right.
So it's a very great rapid prototyping and testing tool. Other things you can do with that is it's a good architecture to provide add-ins, you know, right now, or generate code at runtime. If you want to generate code at runtime today, you need to use, you know, reflection.emit or something like that. Well, we hope that there's going to be a set of APIs that would say new class, my add-in thing, whatever, and you know, add code to that, and then go ahead and compile that code at runtime and create new classes at runtime that we can then execute that code.
So then I have to ask you, because sure. When I was attempting to explain reflection, and reflection is a non-trivial piece of C#, and coming up with places where reflection was helpful and useful to a application programmer was in itself a challenge.
Sure.
Now, I think that's become a little bit clearer, as has the performance problem become clearer. But where do you see, other than for people who are creating tools, where do you see that this would provide powerful utility?
I think it's actually going to be a very good way to produce an add-in model. You know, there's a few different things we could do now, but let's say I'm writing an application and I want to add modules at runtime. Okay. Right now, what I'd have to do is, you know, there's a few different things I could do. One, I could tell people to put a DLL in a place. I'll look for it and use reflection to find APIs or interfaces and then execute those things, attributes, whatever. So I'm loading compiled code. An interesting way to do it now is if we look at Iron Ruby or Iron Python and the DLR, someone could write Ruby scripts and we could load those and execute those dynamically through the DLR.
Yes.
Okay. Once we have compiler as a service, you could put C# source code somewhere on the disk in my add-ins directory. I can load that, ask the compiler as a service to parse it, ask it to compile it, and then go ahead and run that.
So what we have, the two major pieces, just to get it clear, because I did interrupt you a couple of times, are the compiler as service,
right,
which gives you the ability essentially to dynamically bring in code, C# code, at runtime.
Right. And two interesting things just to make sure your listeners are aware of. The one is that is not set for the next version. It is set for some version after that. And I don't know that a specific deadline has been set or a specific version. You can see some early demos in the last two talks that Anders gave at PDC, both in 2010 and 2009. He did a little bit of a demo of the idea of compilers as a service.
Okay, great. So you indicated that you're spending a great deal of time with C# and still plumbing the depths.
Sure.
So tell me about some of the things that you're finding that are the most interesting or difficult or challenging or that create pitfalls for folks.
Well, I'm glad you asked that. That's part of my talk and, at CodeMash is C# puzzlers, why your code sometimes doesn't do what you think it should. And the areas that I find that are still giving people the most trouble or comprehending exactly what's going on is areas around length. It's a very powerful set of APIs, but it's very different from most traditional kinds of programming that people have done. The ideas of lazy evaluation, the ideas of expression trees and function pointers and those sorts of things are very different new vocabularies from the start. And that's definitely giving people, there's some challenges until you really get over that curve and then you get really thrilled with the power that you have.
So let's take a look at a couple of those, if you don't mind. And
sure.
I don't want to preempt your talk, but of course this will be on long after your talk is over. So let's talk about the fundamentals of link, and then we'll footnote for ourselves to come back to expression trees and some of the major issues that you've mentioned. But as a C# programmer, let's start with the very fundamentals. Would you say that to be an effective C# programmer at this point, you need to understand link, you need to be acquainted with it, or you need to have mastered it?
I would say you need to understand it. And I think this is one of the things that for the C# community, there's times I think we don't explain this as well as we should, or in a way that makes it really approachable. In that if you think about writing in C# 3 or C# 4, you know, I don't new up delegates anymore. It's just not the way you code. I write lambdas or I'll write anonymous method definitions when I need that kind of expression, you know, in a link expression or if I'm using the function syntax. But when we explain it, what we'll often see people do, because, you know, the people explaining it are people who've been in the C# community since 1.0, and they'll go, well, so you write this method and you go new delegate, you give a delegate definition and you then new up a delegate of that type and explain what it does, and you have all this mishmash around the code. And then you take people from that and you say, now in C# 2, we get to be able to write inline delegates. You could go, you know, we would see examples of, you know, button.onClick plus equals new delegate, open, close, yada, yada, all that kind of stuff. And now we would go, well, now you just write, you know, open parens, sender, comma, args, comma, goes to, and you write whatever you're gonna, your code's going to be. And I actually think to help people really understand link, start right away with that new syntax and say, you know, the way I explain it is I go, we're just writing bits of code, and this bit of code becomes some data that's going to get executed later. And the compiler takes care of some magic that does actually turn it into a delegate. But instead of really worrying about that, let's worry about the fact that one of the parameters to the where method is a test. And we'll write it in a very concise format and returns true or false whether the test passes or fails. Okay. The select method just transforms an input element into an output element of some kind, needs a little bit of code, and we're just going to pass that code to the method. And now once you understand the fact that we're now actually passing code to these methods, now suddenly it gets a little bit clearer. And we can say that now when you're in memory, when we pass these code to these methods, we are actually passing a pointer to some IL someplace, because that's the way we're going to execute code at runtime. When you're doing something like Entity Framework or Link to SQL, or there is a query provider for SQL Azure Tables, or excuse me, for Azure Table Storage. Well, now we're going to pass a data structure that looks like code. It's a little more complicated. But the reason we do that is then some other bits can analyze that and transform this abstract syntax into a SQL query if it's Entity Framework, or into a, it's the REST call that's appropriate for an Azure Table Storage API. So now I try to take them down that road.
And we see something similar to that. Tell me if I've just gone off the rails, but we see something similar to that with the new Entity Framework code first.
Yes, you can, it's been in the Entity Framework since the first days. No matter how you put things together, when you write queries against an Entity Framework context, that's going to get transformed into parameterized SQL that gets executed in your database engine. It's not pulling the entire table up from the database and then querying the objects in memory.
Right. Okay, right. Let me back you up, if you don't mind, and let's... I certainly agree with you that taking everybody through the history and showing them, well, we used to do this, but we don't anymore. And we used to do this, but we don't anymore, can make people a little crazy. But if you are coming from C Sharp 2 and you're used to creating the delegate, or for that matter, what Visual Studio does automatically, which is you hit plus equal, and it's going to want to put in a delegate for you, complete with the typing of the arguments. If you're switching over to using Lambda expressions, first of all, am I right that Visual Studio will not do that for you automatically in the same way? So on some of the delegates, the event args would be a derived class. They'd be, you know, mouse location event args. I just made that up. Do you need to specify that in the Lambda expression, or is that something that the compiler figures out for you?
In most cases, the compiler will figure it out for you, because in most cases, you're putting it in a location where the compiler knows what the left-hand side of that delegate assignment is and will look at the right-hand side to see if it can make that work based on the what you've given it. If not, there is a concise Lambda syntax that lets you type the, you know, put types in the parameters, which also helps out when you need to.
But for simple event declarations, you don't need to.
Yes. I have always seen the events work correctly when I'm trying to add event handlers, yes. You're right that I think that there are times when we're teaching people or explaining to people who've used previous versions of C#, then I will say, okay, when you write this Lambda, it's just a simpler way to write a delegate. It will compile to pretty much the same code. But I don't like to start there. I like to start with the concept of what you're doing and then work back from that to what the syntax is actually doing, if that helps you get from where a person happens to be to where you want to be with the modern versions of the language.
Okay, so great. So what I think a lot of folks have seen is this, you know, open close paren, and then the goes to, that's the equal sign arrow. And I'm very happy to hear you use goes to, because Ian and I have spent hours discussing what that should be called. we've certainly seen that. We've also seen the syntax, we have open paren, and then something is put into the parentheses. Mm-hmm. Presumably, that would be a parameter that's being passed to the method that's being invoked. Right. And I would assume, therefore, that you can have a list of such parameters.
Correct. There is, if you look at some of the link methods, you will see, well, and in fact, your event case is even simpler. I would have open parens, sender, comma, args. So those are my two different parameters. Close parens, goes to, and then whatever I need to do with that particular event. So you can have as many parameters as you want on a Lambda expression. .NET Framework defines generic types for actions and funcs that I think go up to almost 10 parameters, but don't remember the exact number.
And just to differentiate that, an action is a method that takes 0 to n variable, zero to n parameters and returns void.
Correct.
And a func is exactly like an action, but does not return void.
It returns something.
Returns something, and the first argument to the func is the return.
I believe it's ordered the other way. I believe
is it?
The last one is the return type. Yeah.
Okay.
And then there's a third variant, which is a predicate, which is a method taking n parameters that returns bool.
So that's a special case of func.
Right.
And you can, presumably, you can create predicates using func, but predicates are called out because of the utility of being able to have that simpler syntax on a Boolean. So
right.
You could do an if test.
So this is actually one of the sort of warts a little bit in the language because of when things came across in time is delegates are not comparable by their shape or their structure, if you will. So a predicate of int is different and not convertible to a func of int comma bool and vice versa, which is a little bit annoying sometimes, but not a real big headache.
Yes. So I think when a lot of us saw lambda expressions for the first time and link for the first time, we saw it in the context of putting queries into your code rather than calling out to the database to make the query. And certainly, I think by now, developers who are using it with any frequency are finding that that's a marginal case, that the majority of the time that you're using that syntax is not necessarily going out. Marginal is too strong, but it's that's not the key case. That's not the presumptive case that you're talking to a database necessarily.
You know, interestingly enough, I think it's probably still one of the more common ones, but I think there are a lot of different and more interesting cases. There's two things that I think have been really interesting as to watch the ecosystem grow around this. The first one is that I think adding link into C# almost paved the way for F# because there's some very more powerful even syntax in F# to do some similar queries and that kind of programming style. And I'm not sure that would have been accepted as much if people hadn't seen something like it in a place that was a little more familiar. And I think the other thing about it is code can start to get more concise and still quite readable using query syntax or the fluent method syntax. You know, even to the point where there's people I know that look at, you know, for loops and while loops and go, yeah, you know, why can't we rewrite this using link expressions? And in a lot of cases, you can. And that's actually probably the most common case in a lot of the code I write and a lot of code I see others write is to try to refactor all those loops and nested loops away into some kind of a link expression.
So let me ask you to clarify a bit about the fluent, what's the right expression for it? The fluent method pattern or the fluent method approach?
I've heard it referred different ways, fluent methods, fluid interfaces. The idea is, and if you look at link, so there's some special compiler magic. So you can write a link expression that is like from n in some data, you know, where n is greater than 5, select n times n. Okay, so you can write it like that. You could also write that same query as some data dot where n goes to n greater than 5 dot select n times n. So you can use either that method syntax, and which is fluent because it takes one or it takes in a sequence and returns a sequence. So you can keep chaining those together.
So the output of one method is the input to the next method.
Right. And then in the query syntax, it looks more like a SQL query. The effect is exactly the same.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And but the fluent approach has gotten a lot of currency lately.
Sure.
And is that because it's a natural fit with link or because people are finding it easier to read, easier to maintain, or just because it's the hot thing?
Personally, I think it's a few different factors. One is that the query syntax is bounded. There are only a few keywords in it. So only a certain number of the methods in system.link.enumerable are part of the query syntax. Okay. So for instance, in C# I can't do a take using query syntax. I can only make my query dot take however many I want. Skip, while, several other methods. And any methods developers want to write that aren't part of the compiler team. Right. You don't get to just make up new C# keywords. You can write new methods. So of course you can write however many fluent methods you want, but you can't necessarily write new query syntax. So what I do in most of the code I write and what I kind of encourage is look at the query syntax. If that's a good expression of it, go ahead and leave it. if it starts getting really ugly looking, then go ahead and look at the fluent syntax and go ahead and make that change. And the only kind of rule I try to keep is try not to write one statement that mixes the two. So put a query in parentheses and then dot and do a bunch of other stuff because that looks really weird. So pick one or the other on a statement-by-statement basis and then go from there.
But going back to what you were saying about the bounded SQL, you seem to be implying that by using the fluent approach that you've effectively made that more extensible.
Well, the language did, right? So there's only certain keywords in the query syntax. There's from, select, where, join, group by, order by, and I'm probably missing at least two, okay? Using the method syntax, any new method you want to write can go in there, right? So I'm not saying it's not like it's more extensible, but it's just methods. So you can write as many as you want.
And let me also pick up on something else that you said, which is you mentioned F-sharp in passing, and you mentioned that the syntax of lambda expressions, in some sense, paved the way for F-sharp.
Sure.
Is F-sharp a skill that C-sharp programmers need to have on their radar? Is that a language that C-sharp programmers need to go out and learn?
I don't think they need to. Okay, so I think the concepts of functional programming, which F-sharp is a great way to learn and a great way to put into practice, will help you write C-sharp now that it's got this mixed mode where I can write functional style things using all the things that came along with Lang. It will make you a better C-sharp programmer. Now, whether it's F-sharp or whether it's Haskell or Lisp or another functional language, to get some of those concepts down, I think, is going to make you a better developer. In the same way now, if we want to shift gears a little bit, now that C-sharp 4 is out and we have dynamic support, doing some development in Ruby or Python or another dynamic language will make you a better C-sharp developer because you'll see places where leveraging that tool is really going to help you. You know, now that C-sharp has yet another mixed mode where I can write things in, you know, that are dynamic.
And if you're a .NET programmer listening to this and you're thinking, okay, I want to put that on my list, what are the natural choices in the F-sharp family of languages? Is it Microsoft F-sharp? Is there a different one? And what's the natural choices in the dynamic language?
Okay, so for the functional programming, I would definitely go with F-sharp if you're really comfortable as a .NET developer. That's by far the most popular functional language on the CLR, and there's a pretty rich community around it. In fact, one of the guys that works with us, Chris Marinos, is one of the F-sharp MVPs and has written a nice article for MSDN Magazine on F-sharp for C-sharp developers.
Oh, that's a great resource. We'll have to have a link on the page for this show to that article.
Right. And, you know, there are a number of others. Ted Neward has done a lot of stuff with F-sharp. Amanda Locker. Boys, Rickosaurus on Twitter. Rick, we'll have to look up his last name as well. Obviously, Don Stein produces quite a bit of content that can help people learn that. So there's a lot there if you want to learn F-sharp. As far as dynamic, that's in an interesting space right now that I don't know as much as I'd like. If you are really married to the .NET environment, Iron Ruby and Iron Python would be the best ones to learn. But now that they've been completely open sourced and given to the community, it looks like there's a vibrant community behind both, but it's hard to know if that's going to gain momentum, if it's going to lose momentum. I really hope it does gain more momentum. You know, I think Iron Ruby has a really interesting future, as does Iron Python. If not, I would probably, if you're not married to the .NET framework and the CLR, there is a Ruby implementation for Windows that would be a great one to use as well. And that's a language that's got a fair amount of backing behind it. Ruby on Rails is a really neat web framework. It will also make you better as a ASP.NET MVC programmer because some of the paradigms are similar there. So that kind of learning would also help.
And when you've done all of that, the following week, you should...
Yes, well, this cycles all the way back to the beginning when you asked me if I was still primarily interested in C-sharp, and I am. But in order to be good at that and in order to be good at C-sharp development and to be able to just grow my skills, I need to look around at some other things. I am by no means a Ruby expert or an F-sharp expert or anything like that. In fact, I struggle with both of the languages, but I try to spend some time reading about them and maybe playing a little bit and, you know, small mini projects so that I feel like I'm learning something and maybe I can apply that somewhere else. And those are significant because they're very, very different from what I'm used to in C Sharp.
Tell me about your presentation here at CodeMash.
Okay, so what I'm doing here at CodeMash is C Sharp Puzzlers, and that is subtitled, Why Your Code Doesn't Do What You Think It Should.
And you have one that's simple enough that you can describe it verbally, since this is audio only.
Okay, since we were talking about link a lot, I'll explain one of those there.
Great.
With many link providers, when you get into a query provider, there's only certain code that it can actually translate into whatever it's supposed to execute. So if we think of Entity Framework for a minute, if I have a where clause and I go call some method I wrote in another class, you know, so where, you know, using Northwind as an example, because everybody knows the tables in there by heart now.
Yes.
So if I did, you know, select C from customers, where C goes into, you know, my method that filters customers by who made orders in the last 2 months, open paren C, close paren, that will actually generate an exception. And the reason it does is that the method you wrote is a method call expression. So when the link provider for Entity Framework looks at that and it says, you know what, I don't know how to turn an arbitrary method call into something I can execute at the database engine. Therefore, this won't work. Okay, so now bad things happen. The way you can get around that is there's a few different techniques to get around it. You would either use it if you really need to execute that locally, maybe to do some other business logic. You can take your query and call as enumerable, which says, even though this is a queryable kind of data source that knows how to execute things at the SQL data engine, treat it like link to objects, pull in everything, and execute the query up to this point at the database engine. Give me the results, and now let's do the rest of this processing in memory, right? You can also reverse it back by trying to call as queryable, which, if the data source supports it, will then suddenly move it back down to the database again. Another place you need to use that is if you use the client storage DLL that comes with the samples for Azure Table Storage. That only implements some of the link API. If you're familiar with Azure Table Storage, you can search on either the partition key or the row key or those two fields together. If you do a where on anything else, it will throw an exception because the API doesn't support it. So you have to pull things in based on the partition in the row, and then you can search that in memory. So those two methods help you get the right link implementation, you know, depending on what you're trying to do, and understanding which way you want to play with that and how you really want to get that answer is one of the ones that puts things in place there. And the bit on the guidance of using as enumerable or as queryable, another way to fix that is you could call toList and, you know, create a list in memory, or toArray and create an array. And the reason I don't like that as an answer is that actually does something different. Wow, why are you executing this and putting it in storage in an array? So then the poor guy maintaining your code refactors it and removes that, and then suddenly it crashes again.
Yes.
You know, whereas if you write as enumerable, most developers, once they see that and understand what it's trying to do, will go, oh, he's doing that because it can't be executed remotely. So it does something that needs to happen here.
Yes. Although as a Silverlight programmer, the thought of doing that locally gives me the willies. But
well, and then... Right. So it also sort of is a red flag to go, well, is there a way to change this code so I could execute it remotely?
Yes.
And if not, well, now is the data set small enough that I should be doing client-side filtering or client-side manipulation, whatever that may be? And if the answer is yes, then that's still the right way to code it.
And if the answer is no, then, doctor, it hurts when I do this, then don't do that.
Exactly.
Right. So before we stop, I want to ask you a naive question, but intentionally, because... Back in the day, DBAs were very, very protective of their stored procedures and of the efficiency of queries and the performance of queries. And to some degree, Link, by moving the query into the language, is taking that away from the, or apparently away from the database that does this for a living and away from stored procedures and into the C-sharp, written by C-sharp programmers who are not necessarily database performance experts.
Right. So I think there's actually three or four different answers related to that. Okay. You didn't mention security, which I think is also an important one. And so the first answer there is that the queries that get generated by Entity Framework or Link to SQL will generate parameterized SQL. So it is protected against SQL injection errors. So that's good for that part. As for the performance, I think it's the analogy I use is it's like we're in the very, very early stages of a compiler. You know, you and I are both have enough gray hair where we still have hair that we remember days when people would write in C, and then there were bits of code we'd write in assembler because we could write it fast, you know, so it would execute faster.
Yes.
we're definitely at that point with Entity Framework and things like that. There are queries that a really good DBA could construct better SQL than Entity Framework will construct for you. I'm not a really good DBA, so there aren't a lot of those for me, but for others there are. When that happens, then you should not use Link and should actually have a really good DBA write the stored procedures that you need and do it that way. I expect the surface area of that kind of problem to get smaller over time, right? Because as these libraries get better at optimizing an expression tree in the SQL, I would expect they would have fewer and fewer cases where somebody else needs to write the stored procedure differently.
Right. And and to close the loop on your analogy, we no longer put inline assembly.
Right.
Because the compiler is going to do that better, more efficiently than I can.
Oh, yeah.
And arguably than any right. mortal can.
Right.
And you'll know it when you need it. And that's certainly a marginal case. So I certainly see what you're saying, that over time, that's going to get better and better. And your experience is that the performance is high enough right now. Just to close that down, though, would you consider that to be a profiling performance issue, by which I mean get it working using Link and then profile, and if you have a problem, then go see about optimizing that particular place? Is that the way you would approach that?
That's the way I would approach it in most cases. Some might be obvious enough. You know, if you're writing a particular application and you know this is the query that's going to make or break the thing, then maybe I would start right out that way. But for most apps, I would start with Link and then start profiling. And part of the reason for that is, you know, requirements change as we're moving through this moving target, and it's much easier to change that 5 or 10 line Link query, maybe even a 20 line Link query, than it would be to rewrite a stored procedure, push that to the database, and do all kinds of other things. So I would definitely say, yes, let's get it right, and then if we need to make it faster, let's make it faster. Yeah.
Let me take you down one last rabbit hole, which
sure.
is this. If I'm a Silverlight programmer
mm-hmm.
and I'm programming in C# and I'm listening to this show, I just had a small coronary because it sounds really, really scary and it sounds like there's a lot I don't know. So if I'm a C# Silverlight programmer, .NET programmer, and I want to get this level of expertise, I want to understand all these issues, but I want to do it in a rational way, where am I starting? Am I starting with Link proficiency, or where do you suggest, what's the path you would suggest?
You know, that's probably the first place to start, is to get better at the language idioms that come along with Link and then the APIs that those added. Kind of a foundation on that is generics in general, which I would think a lot of Silverlight developers probably get some exposure to, because there's a lot of generics in that library. And then move on to the Link and some of that stuff as well. Some of the edge cases in Silverlight you're probably already using, but you're using it in places where the BCL or the .NET framework does it for you. And all the data binding uses reflection, like we were chatting about earlier. MVVM patterns, iCommand pattern is kind of a delegate, right? If you look at iCommand, the execute method, that's really returning an action method.
Yes.
To some extent.
Under the hood, it's all delegates.
Right. So some of that you've already seen. It's some syntax that makes it nicer and easier and more concise, hopefully to put the kinds of things you want to understand together in your code closer to each other, so it's easier to understand that.
And then once you've mastered that and you're comfortable with that, would the next step be looking at functional programming?
I think you're going to hit a little bit of those together, but those two would be the big ones. There's a lot of different techniques you can get there that get you to look at problems in a very different way, and I think that's a very useful skill.